Well, so welcome to Perimeter, and I'll tell you a little bit about the dark side of matter today. And like every good story, our story starts in 1897, and like every good story, it starts with a vampire. That's when Dracula was first published. People threw big parties at that year, and many, many people went to the West to search for gold. Now that's all nice and dandy, but there was much more profound things happening in that year, and that year was when Thomson discovered the electron. And just so you have the right set of mind of those people at that time, when he discovered it, he proposed a toast. And the toast was, let's toast to the useless electron after discovering it. Now, at the time, it really did look completely useless. Today, we know how far away from the truth that toast was. But this was the year when basically the first fundamental particle was discovered. 1911, like 20 years later or so, that's when people discovered Machu Picchu. For those of you who like racetracks, that's the first time when they had Indy 500. Anyone been there? No? Okay, you don't like racetracks. Do you know what this is? That's a stolen painting. Do you know which one? That's right. That's the Mona Lisa, well, where it was. That was 1911 for you, but again, something much more profound happened that year, and that is the discovery of the nucleus by Ernest Rutherford. And what we see here is the first example of a modern type of collider where you bombard some fixed target with some beam of other particles, and you observe the scattering that happens. And the scattering was very surprising, as you might know. We won't go into the details of that, but the basic discovery was this picture emerged, that the nucleus is made out of some very hard core, positive charged, with around it lots of little small negatively charged particles, right? Now this picture looks nice and cute until you learn electromagnetism and until you learn classical mechanics, and then you realize that this picture is as scary as a vampire, right? This picture is very, very disturbing. In fact, it's impossible, right? And this was realized very early on, and two years within this discovery, there was a proposal for how to fix it. And I encourage all of you to go try to read Niels Bohr's original paper. You can find it on the source of all knowledge. What is the source of all knowledge these days?
The internet.
Huh? Oh, Wikipedia. Come on, Wikipedia. where do you guys live? And you can actually find the original paper online, and you can read it. And it's a beautiful example of how dimensional analysis, just simple thinking about dimensions, can lead you to a profound new idea. And this is what Bohr did. And his profound new idea is that of quantization of energy levels. So the atom is, in fact, not just this classical object, but an entirely quantum object, where the nucleus in the center is surrounded by electrons which just feed themselves into shells of energy. And there is nothing in between. There is no electron in between. You're either in one of those shells, or you're not in the atom. Okay? This is a profound idea, and with it was the introduction of quantum mechanics. Of course, quantum mechanics was already discovered in 1900 with the black body radiation, but this was the first example of how it appears in atomic physics. Right? And we'll see that this has profound consequences, much more than you might have learned so far. Before that, let's run through the 20th century. And over the 20th century, we have discovered many more fundamental particles, not just the electron, not just the nucleus. We have discovered a whole zoo of fundamental particles. And we discovered them through basically the same sort of methods, by bombarding particles with other particles and seeing what comes out. And today, the biggest such bombardment is happening at the Large Hadron Collider, which you might have heard about. This is the tunnel where those particles are being accelerated. And the most complete knowledge we have of that fundamental particles is embodied in this picture of the fundamental particles making up matter, the fundamental particles making up the forces, and together they're unified under quantum field theory. And the most recent addition is the Higgs boson, okay, in 2012. Now, there are, in some sense, this part is just chemistry, you know, you have this particle and that particle, but underneath all of it, there is a unifying principle of quantum field theory. Quantum field theory and the symmetries that tell you how to arrange those particles. And this theory has been extremely successful over the past 50 to 60 years. It's the most precise description we have of nature. And it's amazing that we have so far not seen any deviations away from the principles that guide us from quantum field theory. Okay, and the most recent discovery, the Higgs boson, is in fact an entirely quantum mechanical. Its discovery is entirely quantum mechanical. We produce it through a quantum mechanical pair creation from the vacuum of top partners, creating the Higgs, and then the Higgs decays into two photons through a pair creation of two other particles. That is entirely a quantum mechanical process that doesn't happen classically. And we do it in this Large Hadron Collider. How many of you seen the movies that this machine produces? Okay, so you're tired and it's morning, so let's see a movie. That's the obvious way to start the morning with some TV. So here is the first booster. Then you accelerate the particles into another ring, and then those particles are taken into a third ring. This is still not the largest ring, but they keep getting accelerated. And then they push through to the largest ring, which is the Large Hadron Collider. And in this ring, you see, you saw several points. Those are where the detectors actually are. And you saw that graffiti? They get accelerated in this blue tube. And those are presumably the quarks in between. This is somewhat of a misleading picture, but it's okay, it will do for now. This is one proton. It reaches, this is where the detector is, and there is another one coming from here. And as they get close, there are magnets that focus them towards each other, and they collide. And when they collide, that's very rare, but quite a few of them do collide, they produce this splash of particles that come out of the detector. Many of the particles don't even live long enough to leave tracks, but we can see their effects. And this is how we detect them. This is, of course, computer-generated. I mean, the event might be real, but ultimately it's computer. Those detectors are being fed to a computer, and that is what generates this picture. And from all those remnants, from all those pixels that come out, you can reconstruct what happened in the middle. Okay, but what does that have anything to do with dark matter? Not quite yet. So let's go back to the beginning of the 20th century, where knowledge was still scant, and all that we had was this picture. And let's try to understand how profound this picture is. You probably have. How many of you have seen it in high school? Okay, so you already know that energy is quantized, and it leads to quantum mechanics, large deviations in the atomic scales, very profound stuff. But I want to actually take you to the very big scale and tell you how this picture tells you something very profound on the larger scales of nature. What it tells us is that there is an atomic barcode, right? That every atom has energy levels that are very unique to that atom, right? And that tells us how to identify atoms. So for example, here is the barcode of hydrogen. Those are the lines that you would see when hydrogen emits light or absorbs light. Right? Here is the barcode for helium. You see it's very different, sufficiently different that you can tell them apart. Here is the barcode for mercury. And even the heaviest of elements, things like uranium, have their own unique barcode. Now why is this important? It's important because now you can start learning things that are very, very far away from you, like the sun. We can tell what the sun is made of. Here is the barcode of the sun. And by looking where the lines appear, you can figure out what the sun is made of. Right? But okay, the sun is still sort of a mundane object. We see it all the time. But we can also learn what the universe is made of. Right? We can ask, how does the light from this beautiful picture, how does that light look like under barcode? And the barcode turns out to be the same. Those are suns in the same way that our sun is a sun. They're not that different. Of course, there are different kinds of stars, but by and large, they are made out of the same elements. Now, this is a profound realization, right? That our entire universe is made out of the same stuff that you and I are made of. You're taking it for granted because you heard it from a young age, but think about it. This is entirely profound, that those stars that you see when you look up, all this vastness is made out of the same stuff that you and I are made of, right? And we only know that because there is a barcode. So we have learned something very profound, that matter is made out of charged stuff, the nucleus and around it the electrons, and charged stuff radiates. It gives off light, right? Light in many different wavelengths. And so ultimately, it can arrange itself in all sorts of ways, but it cannot escape. Sooner or later, we can detect it in somewhere in the electromagnetic spectrum. And here is the electromagnetic spectrum going from the long wavelengths radio wave to very short wavelengths, very energetic gamma rays. And we now have telescopes all over the sky looking at all those different wavelengths. And so if light is emitted in some way from matter, we will see it, whether in the very high energy gamma rays or from a very low wavelength radio waves. We will see it. Okay, so here is a friendly galaxy. It's one of the nearby galaxies, Triangulum. How many of you have seen it by eye? Okay, you're not spending enough time with your telescopes. All right, so it's a fairly close by galaxy. And as we saw, one obvious question we can ask is, what is it made of? Right, and we look at the barcode and we'll figure out that it's made out of the same stuff. Okay, that's getting boring. But what else can you ask? You can ask, for example, is it moving? Right? That's a natural thing that you can ask, even though it may look completely absurd for anyone that never thought about it, because this looks as static as it might be. Right? This will never change in your lifetime. So it doesn't, nothing seems to move. But nevertheless, we can try to understand whether something moves, and it turns out that profound new information is waiting for us there. So here is how we can do it. This is known as the Doppler effect. How many of you heard an ambulance before? Okay, thank heavens. So you know that an ambulance, as it recedes away from you, the frequency or the wavelength that is emitted sounds like it's becoming longer, right? And as it's coming towards you, the wavelength looks like it's getting shorter. If we think about light, this is sound, but similar effect happens in light. As the ambulance is moving away from you, light looks like it's more red. As the ambulance is coming towards you, the light that it emits looks like it's more blue, right? So it's blue shifted versus red shifted, okay? So now we can ask the same about the galaxy. In fact, we can ask it about even more distant objects. Objects which are as distant as the size of this universe. So here is again the absorption lines from our sun, right? We said that those absorption lines tell us what is the composition of the sun. But now let's ask, what is the absorption lines coming from a far away, far and far away galaxy, right? Billions of light years away. And you see that all the lines are there, only slightly shifted. Are they shifted to the blue or are they shifted to the right? Red. They're shifted to the red, right? And the slope of those lines is essentially telling you what is the speed at which this galaxy is moving away from you. And you can do it on all objects in the universe, in galaxies, faraway galaxies, quasars, clusters of galaxies. And now we can start learning dynamical things about our universe. So let's go back to our galaxies. And now that we have this information, we can ask a very simple question, right? Here is a childlike question. We can certainly measure distance, right? I can just measure this part, this part, this part, this part. I know how far they are from the center. And I can also now measure velocity, because I can measure how much this is redshifted, how much is this blue redshifted. And so I can measure velocity. And now I can ask a very simple question, which is, if I now plot the stars as a function of radius, what would it look like? The simplest kind of graph you can draw. And I claim that you already have all the knowledge, not only to find the information to draw it, but also to derive it theoretically, because you have learned Newton's laws. So let's ask this question and try to answer it in 2 minutes. Okay. So have you all learned mechanics? Okay. So you know who reigns supreme in mechanics? F equal to ma, due to Mr. Newton. And we also have the law of acceleration. If something moves in a circle, we know that the acceleration is v square over r. This is not mechanics, this is just geometry, right? So there's no physics in this law. All the physics is in here. That Newton not only gave us this F equal to ma, he also told us how things gravitate, right? That the force that gravity exerts is proportional to the mass of the object that gravitates, and 1 over r squared, the distance squared, right? So we take those two things, we put this into here, we put this into here, and you can do the algebra, and you find that the velocity squared goes like 1 over the distance. Right? Now, these constants here, g and m, you're not going to be able to measure very well, but they don't matter very much. You now have a very concrete prediction that if I plot this curve, radius versus velocity, the velocity should drop as 1 over square root of the distance. It couldn't get simpler than that. Right? This is physics at its best. A simple relation, simple understanding. What could go wrong? Are we all on the same page? Right? Okay. So let's go back to our cute little galaxy, Triangulum. And here is what we expect. We expect, so somewhere in, so when there is still matter inside, we can't quite predict because, you know, we don't exactly know what the distribution here. But as we move away from the from here, we know that we expect it to fall like 1 over square root of the distance. This is what we expect. Right? We just derived it with the, in the most simplest of algebra. Here is what we actually see. Okay? Couldn't go more wrong. Right? Okay, well, you know, you scratch your head for a little while, you think maybe just this little galaxy, maybe there is something funky with this galaxy. And then you start looking at other galaxies, and it just gets worse. Pretty much every galaxy you see has the wrong relation. Here is what you expect. You expect it to fall down, right? You expect it to fall like 1 over r squared, 1 over r squared root r. And all of them seem to just asymptote to some volume. Just doesn't work. Okay? So something went wrong, and we haven't done anything particularly difficult, so we can trace back our steps. What were our steps? We just took this law, right, and applied it. So what could go wrong? I mean, the rest was geometry. So one thing that could go wrong is that maybe we're underestimating the amount of matter. Maybe there is more matter there than we thought there is, and we're just not accounting for it. The other possibility is, of course, that this law is wrong, that it's not 1 over r squared. And I'll give you an example of that later on. But that's it, right? There aren't that many other possibilities. Okay. So, as I said, the simplest possibility is that you're just not accounting for all the matter. So here is a simple example that we already know of under-accounting for matter. And so here is a cluster of galaxies pretty far away, 50,000 light years across. And so this is not a cluster of galaxies. This is just a globular cluster. And so this is how this cluster looks like in optical. So you can see it by eye if you had powerful enough eyes. Right? Now, if you measure the velocities of stars here, you will be confused because the velocities look much faster than what you would assume for the amount of matter. And then you turn your X-ray eyes, and you find out that, in fact, there is much more matter out there that just radiates in wavelengths you haven't looked for. So what this is? This is gas, hot gas that just radiates in X-ray. And it's here. Those two pictures should be superimposed. So in fact, if you only looked in the optical, you would have underaccounted for the amount of matter out there. Okay? So this is the basic idea of dark matter, that there may be some matter out there that you just haven't seen in visible light. Now, it cannot just be hot gas because we would have seen it. We can see in X-rays. We can even see in gamma rays. So it's not something as simple as that. But it's along the same kind of ideas. Okay, so here is the basic paradigm. Here is our galaxy, 50,000 light years across. And the basic paradigm of dark matter is that we are sitting in the midst of it, in the midst of a very big halo of gas, of something else that is not made out of you and me, some other new particle that is surrounding us. And this is accounting for the rotation curves. Okay, so What I'll do now, this is where we are. So we'll stop now. I'll see if we have any questions. And for the remaining of this talk, we'll go through a list of big questions that are still open in this field, and we'll try to understand the whole thing a little better. But why don't I stop now and see if you have any sort of questions about what you have seen so far.
Are there any galaxies that have come close to what we predicted, like sort of follow the shape?
Not that I know of. In fact, there are galaxies who looks even worse, that almost the entire content is dark. I mean, the discrepancy usually happens away from the center of the galaxy. So we are mid-center at 8 kiloparsec. Center is at 1 kiloparsec. And the dark matter effect starts at around 10 kiloparsec.
Are there any blobs where there's no galaxies, but there's just dark matter? Like a galaxy-less blob?
That would be fairly difficult to see, because you have no way of... you know, you need to be able to measure two things to be able to tell how much matter there is there. But you can start seeing, people can start seeing these sort of things through lensing. That's something I'll mention. But in general, yes, in the sense that we see regions where there is very little baryonic matter, but there is a lot of dark matter. But that's not the norm. Yeah. Right, so in the middle, you mean in the core?
Not like necessarily the core, but just like, could it still like create a larger force of attraction towards the center if it was just in the center, not in just like kind of like middle area?
So it's a good question. Remember, the issue is that, again, if you look at this simple plot of velocity versus radius, so here is where we are, here is where the center is, let's say, here is where the outskirts of the galaxy are, and we expect here to start fall off, and instead we see a rise. So whatever is correcting your dynamics has to happen in the outskirts of the galaxy. So if it was just concentrating the core, you won't be fixing this problem. In fact, the amount of matter in the core is dominated by normal matter, not by dark matter. It's really in the outskirts of the galaxy where the effects are most pronounced and most visible. And this is also corroborated by simulations of those things which I'll mention. Yeah?
Why does it align on the outsides of the galaxy and not attract itself toward the center?
Right, so that's a good question. So you might think that, you know, if you just put matter out there, it will just gravitate and infall towards the center. But that's not quite the case, because it has velocity. It's hot gas. Think about hot gas. If you put it in this room, it won't just gravitate towards the center, right? It will try to fly apart. We know of examples like that, like called globular cluster, where you have just stars that are flying apart from each other, and the only thing that is keeping them together is gravity. But because they have some kinetic energy, they do try to fly apart. Okay, it's like a balloon. So in general, unless you have a way to dissipate the kinetic energy, whatever you have will just make a balloon. Yeah.
Do we know for sure that dark matter is a gas, or is that just the most reasonable assumption considering we can't interact with it?
That's a great question, and we'll see some answers to that in the next few slides. Yeah.
You mentioned baryonic matter.
Good. So baryonic matter is what you and I are made of, is stuff like the nucleus, electrons. Really, electrons are not that relevant because they're not massive enough. So really, the dominant amount of mass is coming from the nucleus. And the nucleus is what made out of what we call baryons. It's a type of particle. A proton is a type of baryon. A neutron is a type of baryon.
But it doesn't have inclination with the hadrons, right?
It does. So hadrons... Hadrons are a type of baryon. There are other type of baryon, like pions, which are not classified as a hadron. But that just becomes a classification of... There are remember from that picture that I showed you of the star model, remember this box, right? We had three rows and four columns. And here we had the photon, the gluon, the W, the Z, right? Those are the force carriers. Here we had the electron, the muon, the tau. Those are what we called leptons. Those are very light particles like the electron, which are charged. And those two guys are just heavy cousins of the electron. On these rows, there were things like up quark, down quark, charm quark, strange quark, top quark, bottom quark. Those are what's making up the nucleus. So we learned in the 20th century that the nucleus is not itself a fundamental particle, but it's made out of quarks. Those are the quarks. This row is what's called neutrinos. And in fact, neutrinos are an incredibly interesting story because they are the paradigm of what dark matter could be. Because they are massive particles. There are three of them, in fact. And they are very weakly interacting. That's why it took us so long to discover them. So they could, in principle, have been the dark matter. We know now that they are not, but they're a good paradigm for what dark matter could be. Does that answer the question?
When you say dark matter halo, do you literally mean like a donut shape? Or...
Good, no, no, no. So what I mean by halo, first of all, I don't mean the game. For all of you haloers there, my sympathies, but it's not the game. I like it too. It's just a big sphere, which has some density distribution. So if you look, so it's spherical, but if you look at the density in the sphere versus the radius, it falls. So in the center of the galaxy, it's most concentrated, and as you go out, the density falls. Now, that might be in contradiction to what I told you before, is that the strongest effects are in the outskirts. That's still correct, because the density of neural matter falls even steeper. So by the time you reach the outside of the galaxies, you're completely dominated by the dark component. But it's not a donut shape like structure. It's just a big sphere. Yeah?
Are there any other large problems that suggest dark matter should exist?
There are. Although only indirectly. I might touch upon it at the end, but remind me if I haven't answered it. I can say a few words. Yes?
So far, the only evidence for dark matter is gravitational.
That's right.
So, but sometimes people assume that these dark matter, whatever it is like neutrinos, interacts weakly. Is that just the hopeful guess?
That's just a what?
Is it just a hopeful guess?
Oh, that's a good question. So I'll touch upon it a little bit. It's very difficult to understand why it has the density that it has today if it has absolutely no relation to normal matter. But at some level, you can say that, yes, it's a hopeful guess. But I'll say more about it when we get to the relevant slides. That's a great question, yeah.
So if there are meant to be... dark matter, so the third and not third order. If it's just from the gravitation that we got the idea that there should be this dark matter, how is it sort of determined that you have like the axion?
We don't have any knowledge of whether dark matter is made of axions or anything else, or thermal or non-thermal. Those are just ideas for how to explain what we are seeing today. What you refer to as thermal dark matter has to do with how it was produced versus non-thermal, which is another type of production. One of the reasons we talk about it is because we have some very good ideas for why we are seeing the density we are seeing today. But again, I'll mention it in a few slides. But generally, we really have no knowledge what it is. Anything else? So we'll go through a list of questions, and in this part of the talk, feel free to stop me at any moment and ask more questions about those big questions that we're encountering, because I will try to cover some things, but that might trigger new questions in your head, so feel free. So what is the very first question that is obviously needing asked? Well, is it really matter? Are we sure that we're really missing matter, and it's not just modification of gravity? As we saw, it's really just all relying on this law. Right? and we said that maybe we're missing matter, but maybe instead this law is changed. Let me show you a very simple way in which you can modify things and account for exactly this behavior. It's so simple that you can do it in high school. So here is what led us to this prediction, right? We said F equal to ma, a, this is just geometry, you cannot change that. F equal to, you know, gmm over r squared. That led us to here. We saw that this fails miserably because the velocity doesn't fall as the distance, right? Well, what if it's actually F equal to ma squared over some new acceleration? So I have the velocity. I have the velocity here in bold just because it has a vector. You need some sort of vector. But you also have the velocity divided by some new kind of acceleration. And the law would say, now, of course, you know that this is flatly wrong. You have measured this law in the lab. But what if this law only starts happening when you are going to very, very low accelerations? What if it only kicks in when you're accelerating extremely slowly? And this is what happens in the outskirts of the galaxies. Things are accelerating very, very slowly. Well, let's plug this expression into here and this expression into here. And you see a miracle happens. R cancels out, right? There is R squared on this side. And now because there is A squared, there will be R squared on the right-hand side. And so the final prediction is that the velocity to the fourth power is just equal to some constant. And this is precisely what observations see. And in fact, this constant is universal, this new acceleration. And again, this is what observations see. You don't need a new constant every time. It's one constant that explains all the observations. Now, this is a remarkable feat, right? With a simple modification like that you and I can understand, nothing fancy, no GR, no, you know, differential calculus, nothing. Just change this law and you get a prediction. In fact, there is more. It even tells you something about how it goes. It goes like the fourth power. And this relation, the fact that it goes like the fourth power, has also been verified. So it's not just the flatness, but also what's called a Tully-Fisher relation, that this goes like the fourth power. And both of those things work. Now, this is completely crazy, right? F doesn't equal to ma squared. In fact, this even violates momentum conservation. There are all sorts of problems with it. It's not compatible with GR. It's not compatible with special relativity. But it turns out that you can, instead of talking about this craziness of ma squared, you can transfer the whole problem into a modification of gravity. And that's a little more digestible. It's still inconsistent with GR and all that, but it's a little more digestible, and people have done that. This whole business started with Milgram, and it looks beautiful. But we have to compare with other observations, because this is not the only clue we have for dark matter. And when you start comparing it with other observations, it doesn't work that well. As I said, it does explain all those rotation curves. Yeah?
What is A0? It's a numerical value compared to...
A0 is equal to something like 10 to the minus 10 centimeter per second square, if I remember correctly. Either centimeter or meter. Maybe a meter.
Like 8 orders of magnitude less than g here.
Yeah.
Is there any natural way you could get that?
No.
Okay. Like, well, it's not the Planck acceleration, obviously.
So it turns out that there is some numerical coincidence where if you accelerate something with this acceleration for the lifetime of the universe, you'll get the speed of light.
Wow.
That's
cosmic.
Yeah. It has led to many crazy complications. As far as we can tell, it's just a coincidence. This is remarkable, and it does work on some things. But it doesn't work on quite a few other things. And those are the things that we'll mention soon. For one thing, it cannot explain lensing. So matter doesn't just gravitate when you see it in rotation curves. Matter also gravitates by shifting light, right, by changing the direction of light. And we have seen it. We have seen lensing now all over the place. And this simple theory doesn't explain to you why things lens, right? Okay, that probably is just a matter of modifying this theory and including it in general relativity. So people have tried to do it. It's not pretty, but you can try to do it. It doesn't work on large scales. We have seen dark matter not just on the scale of galaxies. We have seen dark matter on the scales of clusters of galaxies. And we've even seen dark matter in what we call the cosmic microwave background, which is the earliest indication of dark matter we have. And this theory doesn't explain those things. So it does wonderfully well on galactic level, but it fails everywhere else. So at the moment, and together with the fact that it's very difficult to reconcile it theoretically, it's not taken very seriously, but its success should not be taken lightly. Okay, so this is a big open question. You can phrase it in two ways. One way you can phrase it is, you believe that this is the explanation, and then how can I explain those parts? Or you can say, maybe it's teaching me something very profound about how galaxies form. This is just an empirical law that comes out of the formation of galaxies. It has nothing to do with some new fundamental physics. It just has to do with how galaxies form. And you might think that this is crazy, but we've seen scaling laws like that in the past. So that's not entirely unreasonable. Okay, but this will probably be for you to discover. Okay. What is the next kind of question we can ask? So we'll take the approach that this is really matter. It's not modification of gravity. Well, what kind of matter it could be? Is it a new particle? Maybe it could be a black hole. Maybe it could just be ad-ionized gas. We saw that ad-ionized gas already contributes to it. Does it really have to be a new fundamental particle? Something that we have not seen in accelerators before. To answer this question, we should go to one of the most accurate measurements we have of dark matter, and that's not coming from galaxies. That's coming from what's called the cosmic microwave background. Okay? How many of you heard about the cosmic microwave background? Okay, so what is this picture representing? Anisotropy is in what?
The temperature fluctuation.
Okay, but what? This is a picture of what?
Of the sky.
Of the whole sky, right? It's the whole 4 pi degrees sky mapped onto a plane. And what's plotted here are the anisotropies in temperature in the sky. Okay, so the first remarkable thing that we have learned about the cosmic microwave background is that it is a black body radiation to an extreme degree. Okay, just a hot oven. It's not very hot, it's at 2.7 Kelvin, but it's just a hot oven. And the next thing people have tried to measure is not just what is the overall temperature in the sky, but how does that temperature vary from place to place? And we have learned a remarkable thing. We have learned that the variations are extremely small. Those changes that you're seeing here are of the order of, say, 10 to the minus 3 changes. So 1/1,000 or so. And why is this important? This is important because this is a picture of the early universe. This is telling us how the early universe looked like when photons first escaped from the hot soup that the universe was. Now, it's telling us even more than that. It's telling us what happened to those photons from the moment they escaped to the time they propagate to our eyes, our telescopes. So this entire history is being captured in this picture. This is a picture of how matter density was inhomogeneous, I can never say this word, very early on. And photons felt it, because if you're a little bit more dense here, then photons are a little more opaque. They have a hard time propagating. If you're a little less dense here, then photons can stream more freely. So that is all captured in it. But it's capturing more. It's capturing how the universe continued to expand from that moment on. This is roughly 100,000 years after the Big Bang. We have lived long after. We are now 14 billion years or so, 13.7 billion years after. And those photons had to traverse all this time and finally reach our eyes. And during that time, they felt the expansion of the universe. that expansion of the universe and the inhomogeneities in the early universe is telling us that there was much more matter, much more dark matter than normal matter already very early on. Okay? Now, it's a little complicated to understand how this picture translates to those very accurate numbers, like 0.87. This picture is telling us that already in the early universe, the amount of baryonic matter, that's what we call normal matter, the stuff that you and I are made of, basically at that time, hydrogen and electron, was 0.87 times 10 to the minus 27 kilogram per meter cube. We'll see in a moment what that ludicrous number means, but if you want a picture of it, it's roughly half a proton per meter cube, right? So a meter cube is something like that. There was roughly a half a proton in every such space. Compared to dark matter, which was roughly five times more abundant, already that early, not just today, already at that time, it was a lot more abundant. Okay? Now, what kind of matter is as old as the universe? What kind of matter is as dark as that? Like, we have basically never seen it, right? And how can there be so much of it? It's not trivial to have that much of it in the universe. And what I claim is that fundamental particles do it easily. It's easy to satisfy all these three criteria with fundamental particles. And as an example are the neutrinos. The neutrinos were produced at that time. There is some density of neutrinos today. And they've been dark forever. Okay? And they've never changed. So let's just try to get a feel for how much of it. So this is how much of dark matter there was in the universe and there is today in the global universe. But things have since clustered, right? Things have become more dense. Things formed galaxies. In fact, now we understand that galaxies, the reason why we see galaxies is because dark matter started accumulating first, formed the seeds where normal matter can start collapsing and form galaxies. So galaxies will not look the same today if it wasn't for dark matter as we understand it. But let's try to ask how much of dark matter there is in our galaxy today. We saw that back then it was something like 10 to the minus 27 kilograms per meter cube. What do you think is the density of air? 10 to the minus 3, right? Well, more like air is actually heavy, about a kilogram per meter cube. What is the best vacuum? The best vacuum that we can produce on Earth. In laboratories, people spend millions of dollars. The best vacuum we can produce on Earth. No? Okay. This is roughly how much it is. So it's not bad. We do spend millions of dollars on it. But it doesn't come close, right? This is five orders of magnitude less dense than the best vacuum. So there is very little dark matter even around the Earth, even around the solar system, even though it had all the time to accumulate. Nevertheless, we can try to see its effects. Okay, but just this is just to give you a feel for how incredibly empty space is. Right, you can compare it to the best vacuum. All right, so as was mentioned here, all the evidence we have for this new fundamental particle is coming from gravitational effects, whether it's the rotation curves, lensing, something I haven't mentioned, bullet cluster, or WMAP, which is what we saw the cosmic microwave background. But the question is obviously, is there any other way we can see it? Can we interact with it in any form and try to see more of it? And the answer is that we don't know, and this is one of the things that you will probably have to solve, but we have some good guesses for what it could be. And those good guesses lead us to different directions for where we can see it. So one place where we can see it is the Large Hadron Collider. These big collisions that we saw very early in the talk, there was a point to it. And the point is that you can actually try to produce dark matter from the collisions of two protons. How that comes about, maybe we'll touch upon it later, but that's one way you can try to see it. The other way you can see it is indirect detection. If it's out there in the galaxy, right, the galaxy is full of it, and it annihilates every once in a while, we can try to see those annihilation products. Okay, we know that normal matter annihilates, and we can try to see if dark matter annihilates. And finally, something that Canada is very involved with is trying to directly detect dark matter in underground lab. So you've all been to Snow Lab? Okay, you've all wear miners' hat? Okay, have you seen miners?
Yeah.
Okay, rough bunch. They actually go much deeper than you. You know, they go further down. You only went, I think, it's like 2,000 meters or so. I think they go further down to 3,000 meters or so. Tough fellows. So these are the frontiers where we can try to see dark matter's effects. There are a few others, but these are the major frontiers where we can try to see it. And as we said, this is in some level just a guess. We have no theorem that tells us that we must see it here. But there are good reasons to think that we might be able to see it there. If nothing else, we learn about fundamental interaction in the universe. The next obvious question we can ask, okay, so it's a particle. Most likely it's a particle. That's what we are led to. Well, we know that every particle comes with an antiparticle. Is there an anti-dark matter? And if there is, then maybe we can see it annihilate. We know that that's what electrons do, right? In fact, we see annihilations of electrons and positrons from the center of the galaxy. When people look at the center of the galaxy, they see a very sharp line at the energy of the electron. What does that line correspond to? It corresponds to an electron coming in, meeting its partner, a positron, and together they annihilate to give two photons or two X-rays. And those X-rays have exactly the energy, the mass of the electron. You have two photons, so each photon carries exactly the mass of one electron. And this is precisely what we see from the center of the galaxy. So there is no question that there are positrons in the center of the galaxy. Yes?
But where does that antimatter that those positrons come from in the galaxy?
In the center of the galaxy?
Yeah.
It comes from all sorts of energetic processes that spew out positrons.
Okay, so it's being continually created.
It's being continually created.
There's a bunch of it, and now it's annihilated and being depleted.
That's right. Okay. So for positrons, those things get annihilated very quickly. But if you have something more rarefied, like dark matter, it could just be there for a long, long while before it annihilates. And we can try to look for its annihilation process today. I mean, this simple process of electron-positron annihilation is something that I encourage all of you to try to understand. It's one of the most profound processes in nature, and it also has medical applications. Someone knows where is this applied?
When localizing, I think, some kind of cancer, they make it during a substance that produces positrons,
right?
And then they detect it with this kind of...
That's right. So you all seen those big round things that they put patients in, called PET scans? Mm-hmm. Okay, that big round thing is actually completely harmless. That's not what you should fear from. That big round thing is just a detector. The thing that you should fear from a little bit is that part that they inject into you. Because that thing has positrons. Well, what it really is, it's a radioactive nucleide that at some point it goes in your body, at some point decays, produce a positron. That positron meets an electron from your body, it's your own electron, and it annihilates. And as it annihilates, two X-rays come out of your body. They don't interact very much with tissue, so they just pierce your body. And they get detected in this big round thing that you're immersed in. So this big round thing is just a big detector, just like the LHC is this big detector. All the interesting stuff is happening inside your body. Okay? So this process is happening in all sorts of length scales, from the center of the galaxy to the center of your guts. And it's all governed by quantum field theory. That's the amazing thing. But what we're trying to understand is whether maybe dark matter can do the same. And the idea here is, again, if there is some amount of dark matter, maybe it can annihilate. So here is our galaxy. This galaxy, we said, is immersed in dark matter. And so what might happen is two dark matter particles, here they are, come together, annihilate, and we can try to see these annihilation products. Okay. Now, it sounds crazy, in fact, we have telescopes in the sky that now exactly do that. They don't just detect gamma rays from dark matter. We don't know if that happens. There are many other processes that give off gamma rays, many astrophysical processes, yeah?
How do we know that they, when they annihilate, they give off like
Yeah, welcome to modern research. That's one of the things that people are thinking about exactly these days, whether the annihilation can be into something more exotic. Ultimately, you do want it to give off something you can detect, otherwise it's very difficult to see it. But that's exactly the type of question that people are wondering about. What can it annihilate to? I'm giving you photons as the simplest example, also because there has been a recent evidence for some of this. Evidence is too strong of a word for it. There is some commotion about something that has been seen. I'll mention that. But really, we look at all those different things. We try to ask about protons, antiprotons, electrons. This is one satellite that looks at photons, but there are other satellites that looks at electrons and anti-electrons and protons and antiprotons and even deuterium. Great. So no, we don't know at what energy will it be seen. It really has to do with what is the mass of that new particle, if it's there. If it's very light, there is no way you'll be able to see it here because the energy of that photon is going to be much too light and there is too much background. For those type of particles, there are other ways we can try to look for them. Yeah?
Is there any possibility that dark particle is its own antiparticle?
Yes. Great. I had a slide on it in the previous slide. That's one of the big possibilities out there is that it's in fact its own antiparticle. And we know of, or you all know of such a particle. Actually, the neutrino we don't know. That's still an open question whether it's its own antiparticle. Huh? No, proton has its antiparticle. Photon, good. That's right. Relax. That's right. So a photon is its own antiparticle. And in fact, if one of the ideas is that maybe it has a super partner called a Futino, and then the Futino will be its own antiparticle, and those are known as Majorana fermions. Okay. So here is one anomaly that happened in the last few years. This is a satellite that looks at electrons and positrons, and what they are plotting here is the fraction of positrons versus electrons versus the energy of those particles. So for every energy, you record positrons, you record electrons, you bunch them into bins. This bin is for this energy, this bin is for this energy, this bin is for this energy, and for every one of those, you form a fraction. How many of those are positrons versus how many of them are electrons? The general expectation is that that fraction should fall off with energy. And this is this black line. What was seen, and now very clearly with the new satellite, is a rise. So that fraction actually rises with energy all the way to roughly 200 GeV. Okay. Now, there aren't that many good astrophysical reasons why this should happen, but there are a few. One of the ideas is dark matter annihilating, because that will do exactly that. Right? So this is still an open problem. The idea that this is dark matter has its problems. The idea that it's astrophysics is not entirely clear. This is still an open problem, exactly why this rise is happening. Okay. Another recent discrepancy is with what's called the Fermi satellite. It's again, it's a satellite in the sky, and what they're looking for are photons. And this is basically the count of photons. Again, you have photons at some energy, and you put them in a bin, and then you ask how many photons I see in this energy, how many of photons I see in this energy. How many photons I see in this energy? Oh, this bin is a little higher than normal. That's unusual. In general, you expect the number of photons to fall off smoothly. And they seem to see a little blip at around 130 GeV. And this little blip, if it lives on, if it becomes larger, is indicative of exactly this sort of process of two things annihilating into two photons. Right? This is the analog of the 511 KeV line. This is the analog of the electron-positron line. And if this survives, this will be the line of dark matter and will tell us what mass dark matter is. Most likely it won't survive. Research is tough. Leave on. Okay. the next question we can ask is it a single species? We think about dark matter as this one thing, right? But, you know, we're in a politically correct country, so we can try to think whether there are other types of particles. Maybe there are all sorts of variety of particles. In fact, we should think about it even if we're not PC, right? Because we have this example. Nature is telling us that we should be PC, right? We have electron neutrino, we have muon neutrino, we have tau neutrino, three type of neutrinos, and they all interact differently. So there is no reason to think that dark matter is just this single species. It could very well be made up of different things. All right? Now, how can we try to look for that? As I said, this is the star model is in fact a perfect example for that. In fact, the star model is a perfect example also that you shouldn't believe in Occam's razor. You all know of Occam's razor, right? Mm-hmm. And you all told that, you know, it's a deep principle. But in fact, well, do you know what Occam's razor is? The theory should be as simple as it can be, but no simpler. Well, unfortunately, the star model violates it profoundly, right? We have the first generation, God knows why we have the second generation, and no one knows why we have the third generation. You have different forces. Why do we have all this structure? There seems to be absolutely no reason to have those particles. Okay. So as far as we can tell, the star model violates Occam's razor principle very sharply. And that motivates us to think about many species of dark matter. And this is Snow Lab. This is how it looks like deep underground. I don't know where you have been, but all those different caverns are different labs that have experiments in them. And many of those experiments are looking for dark matter in the lab. So how does that work? How can you look for dark matter in the lab? So here is a schematic of how it works because I'm a theorist. This is as far as I can go as far as experiments go. So here is a piece of material. Sometimes they put xenon, sometimes they put germanium, sometimes they put tungsten, sometimes they put sodium iodide. Sodium iodide is basically your table salt with iodine instead of chlorine, right? And they just sit there and observe. They surround this material with detectors. There are all sorts of different types of detector. And you just sit and observe. And you're waiting for dark matter to come in, collide against your nucleus, and leave. Now, they cannot see these lines. Only theorists can see that, right? What experimentalists can see is the nucleus recoiling. And they can measure that energy. And by measuring those energies very precisely, you can try to see whether there has been anomalous activity. And this is what they're doing in all those different labs, all those different experiments. They're trying to see it in many different ways. Okay? I'm going to move on to, I don't want to talk about this too much, but if there are any questions on that, now will be the time. There are many different kinds of experiments. They're using different materials, different detection techniques. The big problem, of course, is how do you know that this was dark matter and not some, you know, your friend's banana or something? I'm serious. Bananas are a serious problem. You think I'm joking, but bananas are one of the most contaminated things, right? Because they have potassium. Potassium have roughly 1 in 10,000 potassium-40. Potassium-40 is radioactive. Now, don't stop eating bananas because you need potassium. But you cannot avoid it. Your body does need potassium for the ions. But potassium does have a radioactive isotope, and that radioisotopes can give you spurious activity in a detector. Okay? There are many other kinds of radioactivities that can give you spurious activity in the detector, and what they spend a lot of their time is trying to figure out how to get very, very clean configurations. The material itself should be clean, the detectors around it should be clean, the people should be clean. Everything that has to do with the detectors has to be super clean. And you'll be amazed how dirty stuff is. So if you like to wash your hands, this will be the place for you to work. I'm serious, it's wonderful stuff. Any questions on this? Yeah.
Through what forces does it collide with the other
atom? Great question. So whether or not this collision happens depends on what kind of interactions dark matter has with normal matter, if at all. If it doesn't have any interactions, then you'll never see this. But we have good reasons, as I said, to believe or to hope that there are some interactions. And if those interactions are there, you can try to see that. Ultimately, we're just going to push those experiments to their limit and probe the weakest forces we can probe. And if we see nothing then, well, tough luck. Okay? So let me skip through this part. If you want, you can ask me about it. It has to do with what we know about the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy. And let me go through the last topic, that I mentioned to you, is can we produce dark matter? Right? And in science, you know, the first thing is observation. So the second thing is that you try to understand the observation. The third thing is that you try to actually repeat the observation and maybe produce it. And then the last thing is that you sell it, right? And of course, you can buy dark matter now. You can find it in Amazon. Maybe not Amazon.ca, but Amazon.com. certain things are not imported in Canada. But more seriously, how can you try to produce dark matter? Essentially, through a process like electron-positron annihilation. Electron-positrons annihilate into photons, but in general what happens here is that as the electrons and positrons annihilate, they give back their energy to the vacuum, right? And then the quantum vacuum can choose what to do with that energy. And it chooses so according to the interaction that it has it is at its disposal. The most favorable thing that can happen is just to create a pair of photons. But if electrons interact with other things, like for example dark photons, then you can try to produce dark photons. Maybe you produce one photon and one dark photon. Maybe you produce two dark photons. Maybe you produce dark matter. And the point is that if it's there, quantum mechanics tells you that it must happen. That you have no choice over. The question is whether this interaction is really there, but that's the whole point of this talk. We are trying to understand in many different ways whether we interact with dark matter in any meaningful way. If we do, we can try to produce it. So here is a process of quark, anti-quark, annihilating into photon or Z and giving off dark matter. Why am I drawing quark, anti-quark? Because that's what's being collided in the Large Hadron Collider. You're colliding protons, but ultimately it's quarks that are colliding, or gluons. Now, this is all nice and dandy, but entirely useless, right? How will you see this? Dark matter, by definition, is dark. It's not going to register in the detector, right? That's the whole point. So how can you see a process like this?
The energy from the inner.
The what?
The energy will be lost.
You're getting there, yeah? Yeah, the energy will be lost.
As you can see, it's going to be missing energy.
Yeah?
Basically
the same. It started to be the good idea, but unfortunately you have many, many protons colliding at any moment. So energy, to know exactly how much energy came into the interaction is pretty difficult. But aside from energy, what else do you know about?
If you don't see anything, then you know, like...
No, but you see things all the time. That experiment is extremely messy. But aside from energy, the reason why you think about energy is because in the back of your mind, you're thinking energy is conserved. So whatever comes in has to come out.
Lack of energy.
Okay, but like we said, lack of energy is hard to measure. But what else is conserved?
Momentum.
Momentum. Right. So if your beam's going this way, that means that there is no motion in the transverse plane. If your beams came this way, then whatever comes out has to balance in this direction. Right? Your beams are coming this way. You don't know how much energy is coming in, but you know for sure that there is nothing in this plane. It's only here. And so when you register, let's say, an electron coming out of this way or a photon, you must see another photon or something else on the other side to balance the event. Now, what if you don't see? This is exactly what you can look for. You can look for electron photons that get emitted in one direction, but nothing comes out in the other direction. And here is an example of such an event. This is an actual event display, and you see that there is only a single particle that is registered on this side of the event. There is nothing coming out on the other side. Those events are what's called missing energy events. It's essentially missing momentum. And the reason why we know it's missing is because of this balance of momentum. Okay, so momentum in the transverse direction has to bounce. So is this the discovery of dark matter? Obviously not. You would have heard about it already in whatever you're listening to. The problem is that this is not the only process that leads to an imbalance. There are many other processes. For one thing, we said there are neutrinos, right? You do produce neutrinos, and neutrinos will have exactly this effect. The question is whether we see more such events than expected. Yeah.
Can you design a detector that's like that, but since we know that neutrinos do occasionally rarely interact, that has one of those detectors and then has like a huge thing around it? That can...
No, that's an interesting thought, but no, it's neutrinos will just, the probability of neutrinos interacting is just enormously small. You'll need something of the order of the galaxy to be sure to stop them.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, you cannot do it that way. You can do it in other ways that are a little different and involve more detailed knowledge. But this is one of the prime ways in which we can look for dark matter in the lab, and we're still looking. So let's wrap up. Where do we stand? We stand with a very strange picture. You know that this year is the centennial for the discovery of the atom. Right, or rather the Bohr model, right? In 1913, Bohr thought about his model of the atom. And as we saw, this model was revolutionary, not just in the sense that it introduced quantum mechanics into our lives, but rather that it allowed us to understand what the universe is made of. And not just what it's made of, but also how it moves. So both composition and dynamics. And through this composition and dynamics, we have learned a profound thing about our universe, right? We have learned that, in fact, this model of the atom, that now we understand it so well, we understand all the intricacies of the interactions, and we can predict things to 10 significant digits. That we are masters of. But it turns out that this is only a small part of the entire universe, right? This is the 4% that atoms and the life of them are making up. The rest, 23% is dark matter, and 73% is dark energy. Don't confuse those two things. They have nothing to do with each other. This was not a topic of this talk, maybe some other talk. The topic of this talk was, what is this dark matter? Right? And this is a truly profound picture, because in some ways, it's the ultimate Copernican revolution. The Copernican revolution was when Copernicus realized that, you know, we are not the center of... the universe, in fact, the sun is at the center. And then people realize that actually the sun is not that special and there are many other suns and it's not even in the center. And then we realize even those other suns are not really in the center, it's just part of the galaxy. And then we realize that even this galaxy is not that special, it's part of a large cluster of galaxies. And even then we realize that even this cluster of galaxies is not that special. It's like, you know, it's a huge, huge universe. And now we are discovering that all this stuff is actually not even most of the universe. Most of the universe is dark, and is not made up of you and me, right? So this is very profound, and it's very strange why those pieces are disconnected. And what we're trying to understand at some level is whether those different pieces are connected, even if very weakly. And there are good reasons to think that I haven't had a chance to touch on. But ultimately, it's a matter of experimentation. We will try to run experiments, look for the connections, and if we find it, that'll be great. Thank you.